I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's August 17th, and we have a lot to talk about. I know there are a lot of members of the Real Talk MS listener community living in Canada, so let me start by giving you a quick reminder that this Thursday, August 19th, is A&W's annual Burgers to Beat MS fundraiser. Over the past 13 years, A&W has raised over $15 million to benefit the MS Society of Canada, and this year, they hope to raise another $1.5 million. So in 2 days, when you visit an A&W in Canada, they'll donate $2 for every teen burger sold through their drive-thrus, takeout, or through the A&W app. And if you're more inclined to be staying in, A&W is also donating $2 for every teen burger delivered by Uber Eats, DoorDash, and Skip the Dishes. Canada has one of the highest rates of MS in the world, and these funds go a long way toward research and programs to improve the lives of people living with MS in Canada. If you don't happen to be in Canada, you can still make an online donation by visiting burgerstobeatms.ca. So please think about making your donation today at burgerstobeatms.ca, and if you're one of our Canadian listeners, remember to stop into an A&W for your teen burger this Thursday. Contributing to Burgers to Beat MS is an easy way to do something good for the MS community in Canada. Now, if you're looking for an easy way to do something good for yourself, no matter where you might live, then you're going to want to pay extra attention to what my three guests have to say. Joining me today are Dr. Mira Rastogi, Veronica Denoma, and Betsy Hartman. And we're talking about the evidence-based benefits of art and music therapy for people living with MS. Benefits that include improvement in cognition, in motor function, and even self-esteem, while enhancing neurological functions like walking and speech. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Mira Rastogi, Veronica Denoma, and Betsy Hartman, there are a few other things that you should know about. Nearly 1 in 3 people living with MS require a caregiver to manage different aspects and functions of daily living. Typically, that role of an informal caregiver is filled by a family member or friend. And unfortunately, the dynamic in this patient-caregiver relationship can be stressful. And more often than anyone would like to admit, it can lead to conflict and even abuse. Research has shown that more than half the people living with MS who require an informal caregiver have experienced abuse or mistreatment at the hands of their caregiver. And a research team at the University of California, Irvine, has developed a standardized assessment that's designed to measure abuse and mistreatment among people living with MS and their caregivers. This new assessment tool is called the Scale to Report Emotional Stress Signs Multiple Sclerosis, or STRESS-MS. And it was created by a team that included MS specialists, experts in the mistreatment of adults with disabilities, a caregiver, and someone living with MS. Now, there are 3 different versions of this tool. One is aimed at patients, one is aimed at caregivers, and one for pairs. The research team tested this new tool by recruiting 102 people who were living with MS and who had an informal caregiver. 47 caregivers also participated in this study. During the study, the assessment tool STRESS-MS was administered along with other assessments during a 2-hour one-on-one interview. All of the data from these interviews was reviewed by an expert panel that included a physician, a social worker, and an adult protective services manager for dependent adults. And the panel determined that 57 of the people living with MS, that's just over half of the study participants, had definite evidence of having been abused or neglected by their caregiver. The most common type of abuse cited was psychological abuse. Almost a quarter of the people living with MS reported being neglected. 18% were financially abused, about 13% were physically abused, and about 5% reported being sexually abused. As mandated by law, the research team actually reported 28 households, or 27.5% of the entire study population, to adult protective service agencies in their home counties. The single biggest risk factor for being mistreated was for the informal caregiver to spend 20 hours or more per week taking care of the person with MS. And that insight could actually lead to a better outcome for families affected by MS, because it implies that simply reducing the number of hours that a caregiver is required will eliminate the single biggest risk factor for being abused. The research team compared the analysis of the expert panel with the output of the Stress MS assessment tool, and they found that Stress MS was valid and reliable for detecting caregiver abuse among people living with MS. I think it's great that we have this tool. It just makes me sadder than I can even describe that we need this tool. Having spent more than 20 years as an informal caregiver, I can appreciate the stress and strain that caregiving creates. But there are solutions. There are ways to effectively limit and manage that stress and strain. I just hope that we're putting the same effort into reaching family caregivers with those coping strategies as we are creating tools to accurately measure the physical and emotional fallout that occurs when we don't. If you'd like to review the details of this important study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. The use of telehealth exploded during the COVID-19 pandemic, with half of all the patients in the United States having at least one telehealth appointment. And while some patients still prefer returning to in-person visits with their doctor, telehealth is certainly here to stay. But post-pandemic, there are still issues that need to be worked out, and the most pressing issue is access. A Pew Research Center survey found that 25% of Americans aged 65 or older reported never going online. And this isn't only an age-related issue. The survey also found that 14% of Americans earning $30,000 a year or less also reported never accessing the internet. Now, one of the challenges that older patients tend to encounter is difficulty downloading an app. And there are also people who, out of security concerns, simply choose not to download any apps. That's why it's so encouraging to hear that Zoom is currently testing HIPAA-compliant technology that will allow healthcare providers to send their patients a link, either through email or text, and this link will connect that patient with their healthcare provider for a secure Zoom telehealth appointment without requiring the patient to have the Zoom app downloaded to their phone or their internet-connected device. The Zoom experience itself will be exactly the same, but it won't necessitate downloading the Zoom app. Zoom is also working on making changes to their virtual waiting room so that healthcare providers can send messages or instructions to individual patients before their appointment begins. Telehealth has proven itself to be a viable option in providing access to specialized healthcare expertise that might not be available locally, as well as providing convenient access to quality healthcare no matter where you might live. It's good to see that the federal government is stepping up and investing in expanding high-speed broadband technology to those rural areas across the country that don't yet have it. And it's great to see Zoom investing in making telehealth more robust and more easily available for everyone. When I talk about new therapies to treat MS, a lot of you might think of a new pill or injection. Sometimes when we talk about therapies to manage MS, we're talking about things like talk therapy with a psychologist. Today, I want to talk about something that may be pretty new to a lot of you. I'm referring to digital therapeutics. Digital therapeutics are broadly defined as treatments or therapies that utilize digital, often internet-based technologies, to create changes in someone's behavior. Digital therapeutics have actually been around for the past 20 years. I think there are two unrelated events or phenomena that have occurred more recently that might be responsible for pushing digital therapies to the forefront. One is the convenience and popularity of apps for our smart devices, and the other is the COVID-19 pandemic, which has often required healthcare to be delivered at home rather than asking people to venture out to a hospital or other healthcare setting. So Wise Therapeutics, a developer of game-based digital therapeutics, has just announced the results of a study that they conducted in collaboration with NYU Langone Pediatric MS Care Center. The study was designed to test the feasibility and efficacy of a mobile, gamified version of attention bias modification training as a digital emotional health tool to reduce anxiety among pediatric MS patients. Now, anxiety is a common symptom of MS, and the risk of experiencing high levels of anxiety is already increased among adolescents and young adults. That risk only gets further amplified when the unpredictability of MS is added to the equation. Now, attention bias modification training helps people successfully modify their perspective or their view of the world around them. And it's been proven to be effective in reducing anxiety in both adults and adolescents. So 37 people between the ages of 12 and 24 who were diagnosed with MS were recruited for this study. At the beginning of the study, each participant had their level of physical and cognitive disability measured along with their attention bias. They also completed questionnaires designed to measure affect, anxiety, and depression. Then each study participant was instructed to download Wise Therapeutics' Personal Zen app and play the games that were presented in the app for 10 to 15 minutes, four times a week, for 4 weeks, or a minimum of 16 sessions using the Personal Zen app. At the end of the study, 67% of the participants reported gaining benefit from using the Personal Zen app. And those study participants who reported the highest anxiety levels at the beginning of the study seemed to gain the greatest benefit. Now, this was a small study, and the research team indicated that the next step should be a larger controlled trial to further investigate whether an app that lives in your phone has the potential to significantly reduce your anxiety and improve your outlook in the world. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. For over 20 years, a nonprofit organization called First Descents has offered free outdoor activities, community building, and skills development to young adults with cancer, providing individualized care, medical attention, and the opportunity to connect with other young adult oncology patients. First Descents has offered local and international adventures that feature activities like rock climbing, whitewater kayaking, and surfing. And all of these adventures are offered to the participants at no cost. I first told you about First Descents back in 2018 when they launched their very first outdoor adventure program for young adults living with MS. And in 2019, Brad Ludden, the founder of First Descents, joined me on the podcast to talk about how First Descents was expanding its outdoor adventure programs for young adults with MS. So I wanted to share three First Descents programs that are planned for young adults with MS in 2022. There's 2 days of rock climbing at Rocky Mountain National Park with expert instructors from Colorado Mountain School. When you're not making your way up the mountain, you'll be spending your time at a beautiful Western lodge where you'll enjoy meals, yoga, campfires, and maybe most importantly, connection. Now, if you're closer to the East Coast, there's a 3-day rock climbing adventure planned in upstate New York with the expert guides at Alpine Endeavors. Your downtime will be spent in much the same way as the Rocky Mountain version of this outdoor adventure, at a beautiful lodge where you'll enjoy meals, yoga, and evening campfires. If you're more into water activities, you might be interested in whitewater kayaking on the Rogue River in Oregon with expert guides at Sundance Kayak School. First Descents programs are for young adults living with MS between the ages of 18 and 39. Accommodations, meals, gear, and instruction for all First Descents outdoor adventures are cost-free. All you're responsible for is getting yourself to and from the location of your adventure, and travel scholarships are also available. These outdoor adventures can be truly life-changing. They'll be great reminders of all that you can do, while connecting you with other young adults who are literally and figuratively sharing your journey. First Descents adheres to and exceeds all of the current public health guidelines. They're monitoring the COVID-19 pandemic, and while these adventures are planned for 2022, the specific dates haven't yet been set. If you'd like to learn more, the first step is to fill out the online program inquiry form, and you'll find that link in today's show notes. Experiencing adventures like rock climbing and whitewater kayaking can be life-changing, but there are also ways that you can gain improvement in cognition, motor function, and self-esteem while enhancing neurological functions like walking and speech without breaking a sweat. And gaining these kinds of benefits doesn't have to rely on taking yet another pill. Joining me in a moment to talk about the benefits that people living with MS can gain through music and art therapy are Dr. Mira Rastogi, Veronica DeNoma, and Betsy Hartman. Managing MS means more than just receiving a disease-modifying therapy. It can also mean designing new strategies and discovering new ways to optimize your health and wellness. Today we're talking about art and music therapy and the role they can play in improving cognition, motor function, and self-esteem while enhancing neurological function for people living with MS. And I'm fortunate to be joined today by a panel of experts. First, I'd like to introduce Dr. Mira Rastogi, a licensed psychologist, board-certified registered art therapist, certified group psychotherapist, and a professor of psychology at the University of Cincinnati, Claremont College. In addition to her other responsibilities, Dr. Rastogi runs art therapy groups for people with movement disorders and multiple sclerosis at the University of Cincinnati Gardner Neuroscience Institute. Veronica DeNoma is a licensed independent social worker at the University of Cincinnati Health Waddell Center for Multiple Sclerosis. As an MS social worker, Veronica assesses and identifies patient needs and barriers to care. She advocates on behalf of patients and families and provides brief counseling and social work interventions relating to adjustment to illness, material assistance, community and financial resources, employment issues, and the Social Security disability process. In 2019, Veronica collaborated with Dr. Rastogi to develop the MS Art Therapy Group at the Waddell Center. And Betsy Hartman is a board-certified music therapist with an advanced practice in neurologic music therapy. She's the director and founder of PNW Music Therapy, a Seattle-based company dedicated to bringing the healing benefits of music to others. Recently, Betsy partnered with Bristol-Myers Squibb and the American Music Therapy Association to help create MS in Harmony. Dr. Rastogi, Veronica, Betsy, welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
Dr. Rastogi, the American Art Therapy Association tells us that art therapy can be used to improve cognitive and motor function, as well as improve self-esteem and self-awareness. Can you help us better understand what art therapy is, what it isn't, and what the process is really all about?
So art therapy is a mental health profession that uses the visual arts, primarily art making, to help people express their emotions that might be hard to access or just begin to express how they're feeling. You can use the images that patients create to work with the client or the patient to problem solve or develop new skills. And you can also use art making and art therapy to help people self-soothe, which helps people regulate their emotions or gain more control over their emotions. And so that's really what art therapy is and how it can be used. What it is not is that people often have the belief that art therapy is used to tell things about people that they don't know about, to make a diagnosis about a person. And we do not interpret art or diagnose people from art, but we use it as a way to help generate conversation and ideas and working through problems. A typical session in art therapy would look different for every art therapist, but in general, an art therapist might start off with a very short meditation to help the patient or client move inward and just kind of center themselves. And then usually there's an art prompt or some way to get the patient or client engaged with the art materials. Then you spend some time while the patient's making the art, and the art therapist may assist if needed. Otherwise, they'll just play a more supportive role or answer questions or help the client or the patient in any way that is needed. And then they will engage in a conversation, talking about the drawing, learning new things about the drawing, and engaging the patient with the drawing.
And what types of patients can benefit from art therapy?
I would believe that anybody who's willing to take the risk of engaging with art materials and creating, that can kind of be intimidating for many of us initially. And if you're willing to just trust in the process and engage with the art materials, even if you just color a page and do something pretty simple, and comfortable, that and most people are willing to do that. So I would say art therapy, most people can engage in art therapy if they're open enough to try working with the art materials.
Veronica, you're a licensed social worker. And when I introduced you, I mentioned that you and Dr. Rastogi developed the MS Art Therapy Group at the Waddell Center. What's your role in a group like that?
I start out in the background, where I do create the awareness. I spread the word to the patients, to the providers, send reminders to everyone in our staff here in neurology that, hey, we've got our therapy going, starting back up for the fall session. I can sense too, when I'm working with patients throughout the day, throughout the week, someone who might especially benefit from it and be able to provide, share information with them. Also, too, Mira and I do very well at playing off one another, picking up on, one question leading to another, because as, working with patients daily and, continually here, I might have, I might be aware of a certain situation or a physical issue one of the patients is having, and can kind of help, bring that out in the open during a session as well.
Is art therapy something that's typically covered by insurance?
It really depends on the certification and the licensure of the therapist and also the state, because different states have this different licensure requirements. Typically, though, if a therapist is licensed as a psychologist and providing mental health therapies along with art therapy, then it would typically be covered. If it's solely art therapy focused and that's the only modality being provided, it probably would not be covered by insurance. But the bottom line is check with your insurance carrier.
And Dr. Rastogi, I know that you've looked at the research on the effectiveness of art therapy interventions. What have you learned about how effective art therapy might be?
So there's a lot of research in art therapy that shows that it is helpful with decreasing stress, decreasing anxiety, helping people feel less isolated, and especially when you're doing group art therapy, helping people feel a sense of camaraderie and decreasing their social isolation. There has been some neuroscience research that shows that engaging in art making stimulates the area of the brain that is often active during times when we are reflecting inward, and that area is called the default mode network. And so it's this network of areas in the brain that help with self-reflection and self-awareness and empathy. And so that tends to become strengthened and activated when engaging in art work. There is some research on art therapy with Parkinson's. And I know we're not talking about Parkinson's, but there is some interesting research that has shown that art therapy has helped with vision and gait. But a lot more research needs to be done with art therapy in the MS community.
Betsy, music therapy has been shown to improve physical, mental, and emotional health and well-being, and the development of neurological music therapy techniques have really spurred the use of music therapy to enhance neurological functions like walking and speech in people who are living with conditions that affect the central nervous system, like MS. Can you help us better understand what music therapy is and explain some of the techniques that are used?
Music therapy uses music interventions or the fundamental components of music. That means rhythm, tempo, pitch, and dynamics to address therapeutic goals. Some of the goals that music therapists might address, especially when working with people living with MS, are things like motor goals, speech and language goals, and cognitive goals. Well, also, when you're addressing all those things, also looking at our mental and emotional health. So how can music therapy help with things like depression, anxiety, or stress even?
So what can someone expect during a typical music therapy session?
Right. When someone's working with a music therapist, let's say in the individual setting, they can expect that the music therapist is going to assess them. That means they're going to get some underlying information of what's going on. And then also, what are they looking at improving? What do they need support with? That can happen by just the music therapist talking with the individual. But more often than not, it happens with the music therapist collaborating with that patient's caregiver or other interdisciplinary team members. So then after those needs are established, the music therapist will create a music therapy treatment plan. And we do this by measuring, you know, what's going on with the patient, and we're measuring those things non-musically. So we don't take any data on how is the patient walking with music. We're going to look at how is the patient just walking on their own. And then we add in the musical intervention. Let's say we're working on gait. We're going to take in and say, okay, now we're going to add our tempo and our rhythm. Rhythmic auditory stimulation is the word that we use. And we're going to see how that patient's gait might change when we add in the music stimulation. And then based off of what other care providers are saying and the music therapist assessment, we'll determine how long that patient should use that intervention. And then at the end of that treatment plan, maybe 4 to 8 weeks, we'll re-measure the patient's gait without the music stimulation to determine, did a change even happen? Can the patient walk with more gait regularity without music after having used music for a couple of months?
Someone's preferences and the type of music they enjoy listening to are pretty personal. They vary from one individual to the next. Does music therapy rely on one specific type of music versus another?
We are first and foremost looking at the fundamental components of music, but then right up along that measurement, we are looking at what is a patient's preference. Everyone responds to music differently. So it's really important to take into account, what is this patient like? What makes them feel good? Also, what makes them feel bad or triggers them in some way? Because we don't want to use that either. So we're always looking at the patient's preference.
Research has shown that the potential benefits of music therapy include improved emotional well-being and quality of life, improved coping, self-efficacy, more energy, better memory, and movement. Music therapy has also been shown to help reduce pain and stress for people living with MS. Betsy, can you share some of this research with us and explain how music therapy impacts MS symptoms and provides these other emotional benefits.
Right. So I talked about how music therapy can address things like cognition, speech and language skills, and even motor goals and motor skills. But then when you're looking at some of these things, like how does music therapy address stress? How does music therapy support pain? There's really interesting research to show how with people living with MS, how music therapy is affecting these things, helping people maintain a level of normalcy, and also importantly, a level of control. What we know is that when people engage in music therapy interventions, either in the individual setting or the group setting, they're saying things like, I feel like I have a sense of control. I feel like I've learned skills so that I can take my health and wellness into my own hands. They might say things like, I really appreciate music therapy because I don't have to take more medicine. It's non-pharmacological support, and I'm able to address some of these issues that are really hard to work through. And so because of that, people report that their quality of life improves. But one of the things that makes me really excited about music therapy and recent research is the effects of rhythmic auditory stimulation and gait improvement. I'll talk about that forever and ever because we see such dramatic results and really quick improvements on people's gait and their ability to move. Even their strength and endurance improves when different music therapy interventions are incorporated into their care.
We've actually talked about some of that research in past episodes of the podcast, so I'm glad it's something that you're tracking as well. Do these benefits that someone gains through music therapy, do they last after that final session?
They do. I mean, I hope they do. you know, what we see and what I've heard from my experience is that patients will get in touch with me weeks or months later and talk about, hey, that one technique that I learned from you, that one music therapy technique that you taught me, I use that every day. Whether it be something like I have a theme song to my life that I play every single morning, or maybe it's something a little more intricate where now I know what my cadence is and the velocity and the speed that I'm walking at. And so I can identify music and the BPMs, the beats per minute that are going to help motivate and propel my movement when I'm walking and I feel fatigued all of a sudden. So I love hearing things like that. And to me, that does mean that music therapy has a lasting effect on people.
And is music therapy something that's covered by insurance?
Definitely. I always recommend that people talk to their provider to see what their insurance covers. But that is an option for you if you're interested in that. I'm thankful that the patients I work with at the facility I work with here in Seattle, that they can receive music therapy services for free due to generous support from our donors. But also know that is an option to receive insurance that you can get access to these services as well.
Well, Dr. Mira Rastogi, Veronica DeNoma, and Betsy Hartman, I want to thank you for giving us some insight into two strategies for optimizing our health and well-being that many of my listeners may not have thought about before today. Thanks for all that you do to improve the quality of life for people living with MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/207. Now you'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. If you haven't yet done so, please don't forget to visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the easiest way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes, and it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. So I hope you'll take a moment and download the app today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.